on 1116 SEN, The Right Time with Gavin Krasiska, Nick Hall and Mark Fine.
The boys are in the house. Two living, breathing examples of recovery and a life regained. Maybe even a life not only regained, but a life better than what preceded their addictions. Gavin Krasiska, of course, was a mighty magpie. And Gavin, good evening to you.
How are you, Farnie?
Now, we had a bit of fun tonight because we had Dustin and Fletcher. Now, we had Dustin Fletcher in review and talked about the fact that he played in the first Anzac Day game. And I brought the two teams up. And, of course, there he was, Collingwood, 26 years of age, Gavin Krasiska in the first Anzac Day game.
They were big games.
A draw. How many did you play in?
The five. Yeah.
Love them?
Yeah, look, they were as close as you could get to grand final atmosphere and experience. And I guess because we were the only game on that day as well, it was, I don't know, just really set it up and we felt special. And I know Sheeds did a lot of really hard work behind the scenes to really promote that game. And it, I'm very proud to say that I've been a part of the start of the Anzac Day game between Collingwood and Essendon. It was a really great experience.
And did it broaden your knowledge of the Anzac experience and the Australian war experience?
No, I was with Collingwood, so we didn't get as many teaching seminars around the Anzac. We did bits and pieces though. Lethal did the first year, and we learned a little bit. Sure, he wasn't as big on it, but it was certainly about reaching back and really digging deep the way the Anzacs did back then. It just would have been a terrible experience to be a part of back then, I can tell you, just knowing that you were going to run into a hail of bullets.
Mick Hall in 1995 on Anzac Day could have been doing anything. Good evening to you, Mick.
Top of the evening to you, Finey. Gav.
How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good.
Breathing.
I'm pumped. Pumped right up.
Always good to have a pumped up Mick Hall. Now, 1995, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember, or did any day make any difference? Was Anzac Day different to Wednesday? Was Tuesday
two
different
days,
to Christmas?
Finally, 2 days stand out in memory for me. I think it was 1997, the Melbourne Cup. Might and Power won the Melbourne Cup, and I know that because I won the sweep in prison. And I won something like 100 packets of Winfield Red and about 50 cans of Coke. The day that I was meant to be getting paid out, they shanghaied me out of the prison and I got transferred to another prison and I never got to collect.
That's karma for you.
And the other day...
Is it easy to collect a bed in prison?
Oh, you need a couple of people. Collection.
A bit
of collection support.
So you have to pay some of those Winnie Blues, get paid in... protection.
Well, a few things happen. You've got to make things happen. But
less tax.
Good old Winnie Blues.
So, but 100 packs of ciggies and 50 cans of drinks, less tax.
Less tax, that's right. Exactly right. And the other day, which is, I guess is a bit of a contrast to that, but the other day that I remember, I don't know the date or anything like that, but I certainly remember exactly where I was when I heard that Princess Diana died, and it shattered me. And I remember walking back into my cell and, just a great sense of sadness hit me. That was the other one.
Okay, I didn't know.
Didn't expect that, did you?
Yeah.
Neither did
came
I.
Came out of nowhere.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, there.
There's 2 days.
There you go.
In the light.
I remember Anzac Days, or the build-up to them, simply because I was always at the play on Hurd. And he was just the type of player. In fact, it's no good for Hurdy, but there was, I think out of the five, I think he missed two through injury. And the relief, when you're anxious and then you lose it.
Yeah.
Awesome freedom, freeing feeling. And
I feel like doing cartwheels.
Yeah. But he was such a difficult player to play on across half forward because of his size and his speed. And I had the size for him, but I certainly didn't have that off the mark speed. And I used to have some very nervous Friday nights Wednesday night before the Thursday games, as they were back then. But, I reckon I got him twice, and he got me.
You didn't have that
once.
You didn't have that off the
That's
mark.
That's my story.
Yeah. I like it. I wish I had that story.
You didn't have that off the mark speed, but there was other speed in your life.
Yeah, there was. Not a great deal. Look, not a great deal back then either. But it was building.
Yeah. Mm. This, so we fast forward to the present, and there are very different lives being led. Gavin's in his fourth year of recovery. Mick heading into
15th year, yep.
15th year of recovery. And tonight, we're trying to peddle a positive message, because we know that there's a fair bit of doom and gloom out there about addiction and about the grip that ICE has on society, and that almost, and we've discussed this before, almost is a problem for people addicted with other addictions, because it, we've discussed, in some cases might almost justify behaviours, saying, well, it's not as bad as type thinking. But I thought tonight we'd peddle a positive message, and that is what recovery can bring and how you've turned your recovery into great service for the community. I want to touch on, first of all, is it natural, so many people, and I'm currently involved with a young bloke, and I won't mention where from because that would probably be obvious to some people then who the person was, who in his battles is currently in a much better place than he has been and really wants to do some fundraising, just wants to be that sort of angel on people's shoulders that you guys have become. I want you, maybe Mick, to tell us not only why you've immersed yourself in a life that involves helping others in rehabilitation and then recovery, why you launched into that study, because even before it became a commercial possibility, you chose to make it your part of your recovery in learning, and that was long before dollar one was earned. So is there a reason why, do you think?
Yeah, look, there's a few reasons why, Finey. I guess for me it was a natural progression, you know, and I think that one of the things that happens when you come out of genuine adversity and you really, truly make it out, there's an enormous sense of relief. Like Gav was talking about before, even just with the anxiety, you know, it's the same sense, it's just the absolute sense of relief. And once I had that sense of relief that I was making it out, I knew what other people were going through that were still stuck in it. And I'd found a way out. I'd actually found a way out. And so there was this deep sense of wanting to pull as many people onto the lifeboat as possible. And through doing that, I got such a sense of, for the first time in a long time, I felt good about me, you know, and all through my addiction, you know, truth be known, I hated who I was. Deep in my heart, I hated who I was. I thought I was pathetic, dumb, weak, you know, all of the labels that society may put on a junkie or on an addict, they were nothing compared to what I'd put on myself. They couldn't hurt me like I was already hurting me. And when I first got clean and sober, I was, number one, absolutely amazed. Like, it's hard to explain. Like, I couldn't believe that, what, you mean I'm worth it? Like, the powers that be, whether that be the universe or the higher power or just other people in society that were trying to help me, I'm actually worth it. Like, does this mean that I'm actually worth it? And the more I tried to help other people to achieve the same thing, the more I felt self-worth as well. So I began to build my self-esteem by doing esteemable acts, which means that I started to act and think and talk differently, you know, and that is what started to produce a deep and profound shift in thinking and emotion, which is the basic requirement, really, of true change and true recovery. And so that was a great thing. And then And then, of course, you know, I'm one of those guys that just had such a messed up, horrendous, horrible life that I'd made such a mess of things that I had no education. I mean, I left school at 14. I had my last legal job at 17. I had no work history. I had a prison history. But I had this deep down thirst to want to help people to get out of the life that they were in. So to me, it was a natural progression.
So was that a conscious decision when you first went into alcohol and drugs study or work? Was that a conscious decision? Because I think Fonny's asked us before on whether we do it for our own personal recovery. Was that even in the back of the brain? Well, were you actually thinking that at all? Or
no.
Does it just become a part of it because of that esteem you're talking about and the help we provide?
I guess it just becomes a part of it. It did for me, yeah. Gav. So I tried some other things before I got into drug and alcohol work. So
is that lawn mowing business you were talking to me
about
before?
Yeah, I've always been sort of entrepreneurial, or I've always had that, I could tell that I've had that creativity and that want and that need and that drive to do something, but I've never been able to, I've never ever been able to see that potential because of my addiction.
Mm.
And the first thing that started to become apparent to me is I had this drive to want to, I don't know where, but just get further than where I was, you know. And at first that was just like getting a job. I mean, I tried to get a job as a, I was a stock picker. I worked for Whole Proof, and I was on a forklift picking stock. And I think I did that for 4 or 5 months, and but I was emotionally and psychologically incapable of holding down that job because...
You didn't want to tell people you were in lady stockings?
Well, I didn't mind that. But, but when you break your fist because you're punching out the windscreen of a forklift because somebody's talking to you in a way that you don't like, you know, you're not really kind of conducive yet
to
living in society. But I knew that for me it was a dead end. You know, like, what was I going to do? You know, I was searching. I was just this searching. I'd been searching all my life, like... And the first bit of recovery was the first part of the journey where I went, oh, my God, like, this is, I might be able to do something here. And I was freaking out. I didn't know what to do. And I tried a few different things. They didn't quite kind of work for me. And then at the very beginning of my recovery, my then girlfriend fell pregnant with my son. And I wanted to be a father. I wanted to be somebody who my son could look up to and be proud of. I wanted to be somebody, you know, and I thought, how am I going to be somebody? Am I going to be Mick the factory worker, which is all I'd thought my whole life that I was worth? And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you want to do. But I knew that that wasn't for me. I knew I needed a deeper, stronger purpose to hold me in employment for a start and to guide me, you know, to help me in my life. And at the very beginning, I was dead against, I'd hear addicts and alcoholics talking about the fact that they were getting into drug and alcohol work, and I'd roll my eyes and go, oh, here we go, another one, saving the world, right? I was kind of against it. It's kind of conflicting, isn't it? But I was kind of against it. And then I was brought to a point, I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? Like honestly, I'd never even thought of a career before. I didn't even really know what a career was. I'd heard talk of it on TV or heard people say they had careers, but it was never part of my reality ever. So I didn't even really know what that was. My then partner was pregnant. I had that desire in me to be somebody, and I needed to find my way, you know, and I thought, all right, I'll give it a go. And I got started, and, you know, my career kind of took off from there. And, you know, it's been a really important part, not just of my recovery, but of my life. You know, I don't consider me being at work at Dayhab, you know, in... As you know, as this is what I'm doing for my recovery today, I do it as part of, all right, this is my purpose in my life, and this is what I'm doing, and that's where it is for me, you know, and that just seems to kind of form part of what has become my recovery. it's kind of fallen that way. Geez, that was a long-winded answer, Finey. Bloody hell.
Bloody interesting.
I've forgotten the question.
So have I.
We've got to take a break. 9429 1116. If you are somebody who is in recovery or close to somebody in recovery, tell us what marks your recovery as special to you. And we'd love to know what you do to earn a crust, because in the end, the normal world awaits, and the normal world for nearly all of us requires a living to be earned. And I'd be fascinated, and our listeners would love to hear what you do and whether it's different to what you were doing prior to addiction taking hold in your life. So 9429 1116, 0433 981116 via the SMS. When we come back, I'll ask the same of Gavin Krasiska. His life has certainly changed. We know the man that was being touted as a future AFL coach is no longer in that world. We'll find out what it means to him to work in alcohol and drug, in the alcohol and drug industry, not selling it, but helping people recover from an addiction to it. And I've got four questions that came up while Mick gave us that long but very interesting answer, and I'm going to put them to Mick and to Gavin after the break. Welcome back to The Right Time. We are talking about the life after addiction, but of course, if there's anything you want to ask these two learned men, Gavin and Mick, re your own situation or that of somebody that you care about, then of course this forum allows you to talk about any topic in relation to addiction. And one off the SMS for a couple of well-travelled gents such as yourself. Bit off topic, no such thing. I've been on methadone for over 2 years now for a pain-killing tablet addiction. I'm finding it almost impossible to come off the methadone. But more scary is the fact that a big part of me doesn't want to. My family and friends are constantly asking me when I'll be coming off it, but I can't give them an honest answer. I don't know what to do. Any ideas? I'll withhold the name and the suburb.
Is that an interesting replacement for painkillers? Is that what they would use?
No. It is used sometimes, and it's methadone is a horrible drug. You know, like, it's just so physically and psychologically addictive. You know, and it is difficult to come off. So I can speak from experience myself. I was on methadone.
Mm.
Not for coming off pain medication, but for coming off heroin, which is,
same,
you know, your illegal pain medication, we might as well call it. And so the advice that I can give, or I guess the feedback that I can give, is that when you do make a decision just to come off methadone, don't just jump off it, all right? So I think that in my experience over the last 14 or so years, you know, working in the industry, is that the people that jump off, you know, methadone really quickly, you know, have a very, very hard time with it. The most successful way that I've come across is to reduce very slowly. So, and the person that's having this methadone will probably understand this terminology. You guys may not, don't know. But if you're on, say, 40 mil of methadone, which is about it's a moderate dose. A high dose would be around 70 or 80 mil or more. That's an extremely high dose. 40 mil, 40 to 50 mil is a moderate dose, but still very hard to get off. For
You'd
me,
be pulling 2 mil every fortnight, wouldn't you?
Beg pardon?
You'd be taking off 2 mil every fortnight, wouldn't you?
I would do 1 mil.
A fortnight?
Yep.
Jeez.
1 mil a fortnight.
But I think the key thing to that, Mick, is, and we had a boy that came from a public hospital, which he went in with ice and Xanax concerns.
Yep.
And he came out on about 300 milligrams of Seroquel, which is a anti-psych type medication.
Yep.
Which you can almost go with to
that
start with.
That was the flavour of the year not long ago. Yeah.
Yep, certainly yep. was. But he was on 60 milligram of Valium. So this kid came to us.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely, he might as well have been popping
yep.
10 bricks of Xanax a day.
Yep.
Like, to get him off the Valium
yep.
took so long, and the poor kid's actually, we've had issues with him at the moment because he's struggling a little bit. But I struggle with people getting on a methadone program like this without a reduction plan.
Yeah, it's got to be a reduction plan.
And how will you just land someone on that and say, okay, we'll come back, keep coming back every month or so to check up and we'll take it from there.
But, you know, like when we say a reduction plan, so it's one thing to have a regime. So like, as you know, with Valium or with methadone, we go, okay, so there's a regime. So we know with Valium that, you know, if a person's having two in the morning, two at lunch, two at tea and two at night, you have two in the morning, one at lunch, two at tea, two at night, right? And then the next day you cut it one by one by one by one. So that's one aspect of the reduction regime. But what probably, as you and I both know very well, that the most important part around that reduction regime is the support that's around that person psychologically and emotionally while they're doing it. Because it is a tough time, let's face it. Just as it is for guys coming off Valium or diazepam, it is also horrendous coming off methadone.
Mm.
Methadone gets into your bones.
Well, I was going to say, the thing that some people don't realise is that you're going to have to go through some sort of internal pain.
That's right.
As you said, mentally, emotionally, physically, whatever it may be, all of the above.
Yeah.
You have to get off those things, you'll have to go through some uncomfortability and discomfort. That's just a fact.
There's no way around it. But we can minimise it and you can make it easier on yourself by not doing something silly.
Yeah.
You know, so where things go arise, I can't tell you how many people I've come across that have been on, say, 40 mil of methadone. They go, no, I want to be off it in 2 weeks. Mm. So I'm going to drop 20 mil today, and next week I'm going to drop 10 mil. And then next thing I know, they are in absolute
mess.
Turmoil. You know, and they either have to jump back onto a higher dose to hold them, to get rid of those. So remembering that when you're taking methadone, it's not so much now about the pain, right? It's about having that dose of methadone is about stopping withdrawals now. There's no other way to put it, right? It might be a little bit about the pain, but it is once you're on methadone, you're taking that methadone because if you lessen the dose, you go into withdrawal.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So medically, you've got to keep taking the methadone. And then that can be tough because that can be a real breaker in somebody's decision as to whether or not they actually want to get off it because it's so hard. Mm. And you've got to go through withdrawal. If you're going to drop a mil a fortnight, you've got to go through withdrawal.
Continually.
Every 2 weeks for 20 weeks.
So
40 weeks.
Say whatever. For somebody addicted to heroin, trading that for methadone is really...
Swapping one problem for another.
Wolf in sheep's clothing.
It is. Just the only difference is that it's legal. You can get it prescribed and you don't have to go and do a berg or go and do a stick-up to get your hit. So with the opiate addictions, it is, believe me, it is medical reasons. So any addict out there will talk about using, right? If they've got a habit, they're using so that they don't have to go through withdrawal. Right, and so one of the things if you're using illicit substances or you're using illegal substances is there comes times where you can't get it or you haven't got the money for it and you have to go into withdrawal. That's when people get really desperate. You do silly crap. That's where you hurt other people. That's where you end up in prison. That's where all this stuff happens. So the government says, well, let's do a bit of harm minimization there. Let's legalize this particular substance. And methadone isn't the only one. There's other drugs now.
Isn't there nicer ones?
No, none of them are nice.
Mm.
None of them are nice because they're all hard to get off.
Mm.
So in the end, if you're taking methadone to avoid the withdrawal symptoms that come from stopping taking, say, heroin.
Yep.
In the end, those withdrawal symptoms, if you want to be completely clean, you're going to have to pay... You're going to have to pay that very expensive price somewhere down the track?
Well, that's exactly right. And so methadone gets right in deep. And what it does is it rots your teeth. Okay, so you see, a lot of people that are long-term methadone use have got no teeth left. And people get very, very thin on it. They get, they become very unwell. It's just as horrible as using smack, except you don't... you can go to the chemist and you can get it for $5 a day or whatever. But you're held into that pattern. And I know scores of people...
If you're not planning to come off it.
If you're not planning to come off it.
Yeah.
And the people that do plan to come off it, a lot of them, a large percentage of them, end up, if they're addicts, end up using again. because it's just so hard to come off, and they try, and then their head goes, and then next thing you know, they've got to go and use, because it takes time to go back to a doctor, the doctor to get a permit to prescribe the methadone, to go and get it. They're better off going down and scoring and using illicit substances, buying some smack off the street and using it to stop the withdrawals so that they can then go through the process of going back to the doctor. Right, so this is the thing where harm minimisation, there is a role for it. There definitely is, but it can also be part of the problem too.
Mm.
Back to...
Well, we went on a trip there.
Back to recovery. So, Gavin, we know that your life in recovery is very different to beforehand. You're involved in literally alcohol and drug help, but in that field, were you drawn towards it for the similar reasons to Mick?
Well, look, it was at the start. It really was. It was. I was in such denial of even having a problem, because my behaviours and my use and my drinking and all the things that I was doing was just what I thought I needed to do to get through a day. So I didn't look at it. I was unable to look at the problem. Things were falling apart around me and I didn't even see it. The drugs and alcohol became my number one priority, and I just didn't know what was going on, and in the end was quite delusional with how I was going and how I fit into the world. Similar things of what Mick said in terms of knowing that I basically was doing the wrong thing, but just had no ability to be able to stop. And so, therefore, the worthlessness and the hopelessness and the negative self-talk on how I was and how I could get to this stage from where I'd come from, playing footy and then coaching. And as you said, Finney, touted as a possible AFL senior coach down the track and all that sort of stuff. And I would bash myself up over this while I was driving to my dealer, making sure that I was ready to get me through the next day. Because if I didn't, I just would have been in a world of emotional pain and regret and remorse of what I had created. And when I first got into recovery, and as it's well documented now, it was basically through an unstructured intervention with my wife, Nicole, where she got me into a hospital where I wasn't high-fiving going in there. I just was basically just stuffed and was just going along for the ride. And I just saw the numbers and the people that were actually getting well, and I thought, okay, with this, there's a name to my problem, and I was able to identify what was going on for me through other people talking about their own situations, and that really got me thinking about the impact I may have, being obviously an ex or a former AFL player and having a profile and so forth. And you know, when I came out on Eddie's show, I think I was about 18 months, the impact I had on many people in terms of that really, I guess, not spurred me on, but it made me want to help others. Because I, and not to say that I wouldn't help everyone, but by me coming out and being public about my situation, so many people say how courageous you are, and look, I can understand that, but I just don't think it's courage. It's just what I've done to try and help others.
Yeah.
And I know the impact I've had on people. And, you know, I did H&I, the hospital where I've started my first 28 days. And I say this with complete humility and not ego. One of the guys that was in there after I spoke said, put your hand up if Gav Krasiska's had anything to do with you getting to this private hospital. And and out of, you know, 30 people, there was about 20, 22 people that actually put their hands up. And it was indirectly or directly from my work or also hearing about my stories. And you know, like a 45-year-old woman coming up to me at South Yarra AA meeting about 18 months ago saying, Gav, the reason why I'm here is because I saw the Eddie McGuire thing and I thought there's something wrong with my drinking as well.
Yeah.
But that's, for me, that's just... that's really, really nice. It's a really good feel good. To know that I've had that impact. And I always go back to the States and look at Robert Downey Jr. and I know them, but I never remember the names. Like, there's so many people, Hollywood celebrities or people that play music or whatever it may be in the States that are openly in recovery and stick their hand up and spruik it and say, I'm proud to be in recovery.
Yep.
And I can imagine all the people that would look up to these stars and go, well, I'm going to, you know, I want to try and do something differently. And I think it has huge impact. And that's basically why I went into what I went into. obviously meeting Belinda and having that family connection, huge on the family part of it, on being able to not just help the attic, but bring in the family, because I saw the destruction, the carnage I created in my family,
yep,
in terms of mainly Nicole, but others around as well. And I saw how I twisted her into the spider web,
yep,
and made her sick. And then without, and I've also seen, now that I'm in recovery and Nicole's in recovery, I've seen the impact that her recovery's had on my recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of boundaries and I guess consequences, if they're there or if they need be, which I certainly don't need consequences anymore because I can own my stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But it's really about her being in recovery and knowing what it takes to keep me in recovery. Like, you know, Thursday night Box Hill NA meeting is my meeting, and I can get home from work and completely forget. Nicole will say, "What about your meeting?"
Yeah.
And I say, "Oh, yeah, okay, no worries. I'll get off the couch nice and warm and go to the meeting." So
you do the drill.
That family impact on what families, how families can help a loved one if you have family, is a really, really key part and a really important part of someone's recovery journey. So,
we need to take a break. When we come back, Dario in Mount Evelyn has rung in, and I have these questions to ask of both of you. There's certainly a concurrent theme here, and the commonality is being in a position to and wanting to help others. Gavin through his profile, Mick through his enormous, well, you know, many years as a key student, as a top student, ducks of the class in the world of drug taking and all the shenanigans that goes along with it. There's not a trick you could pull on him. So when we come back, I'm going to ask, maybe explore the reasons behind the want to help. Like the right time.
Like the right time. Like the right time.
Welcome back to The Right Time. Gavin Krosiska and Mick Hall. Let's go to Dario in Mount Evelyn. Good evening, Dario.
How you going, guys?
G'day, Dario. Hello, mate.
Yeah, first time, long time. I love the radio station. Okay, now I've just got a comment to make about the methadone. I found it personally that it was a lot better than being a complete junkie. And when it was time to get serious and try and get myself off it, I came off at 2 milligrams every fortnight. And just on the night that I dropped down, I had a bit of a sweaty night and maybe not the best night's sleep, and then I was fine. So, I just wanted to say that if you're really serious about it and you realise that it's something that you're going to have to deal with every day for the rest of your life, it's going to be in the back of your mind, then it's possible to do.
I completely agree with you there, Dario, and I love the way that you did it too, and you dropped so slowly. When we say 1 mil, 2 mil, whatever sort of feels right for you, or for the person, but look, I was the same too, you know, like the methadone definitely had its place, you know, like that saved me in many ways going on to methadone, but it still did become a problem in that, you know, like you said, if I didn't get to that point where I was going to put in the footwork to reduce from it, then I'd be stuck on it forever. And of course, as we know, the longer you use opiates, the more tolerance you build up, and then the more you got to have of it for it to hold you.
Look, we can't downplay the importance of getting away from the illegal nature of heroin, not because we're speaking on behalf of the law and order keepers, but because part of getting into a mind space of rehabilitation and recovery is to end associations, to throw away the mobile phone, the black book, or wherever you keep those phone numbers. And you can't do that if you've got to go back.
Although you do all meet at the chemist.
Well, I'm saying there are dynamics,
yep,
which leads me on to some questions, yep, recovery and working in the alcohol and drug industry. You call it alcohol and drug. I keep thinking that you're either working for a pharmaceutical or for a brewery. But in the addiction / rehabilitation / recovery industry, which is now very much an industry. So question number one is exactly what you said, meeting at the chemist. For either of you, was there a sense of any danger working in the industry because you are still very close to the flame. You are dealing daily with people who are trying to beat addiction, which means it's right there in front of you.
It was a very big concern for me when I first started, and certainly being an ex-heroin addict, you know, I used needles every day. So the jobs that I took on required me being around people that sometimes would relapse, and they'd use, there'd be used syringes, there'd be all of that sort of stuff, and they were major triggers for me to start with. So, yeah, I had to have my guard up, but I was firmly in recovery. I had a good program, you know, and a good sort of set of disciplines that I used. I had some good teaching. So getting the qualifications means that you're equipped with certain boundaries and strategies and frameworks around you that can protect you, you know, and I relied heavily on that.
Gavin, any danger being right back in
there? No, just cruising me. I just sort of flipped through and there's no worries with me.
Good stuff.
No, look, my only thing is I'm not triggered at all at work. I get triggered outside of work. It's not necessarily in work, but I do get a little bit concerned with others' behaviours. Not to trigger me into craving or anything, but their behaviours I get worked up on.
Yeah, okay.
And I reckon that's an experience. But
yep. Yeah.
Next question is: was it an easier industry, say, for you to get into, Mick, because of your criminal history?
Yep.
That it's one industry where criminal history might even help rather than hinder.
Yeah. Yes and no. Of course, you know, it's. Yeah, I guess it was an industry that I could get into where, yeah, there's lots of assets. And a lot of my past is an asset because I have changed. You know, it's more than just black and white. You know, like when I first got into the industry, people could see that I was a passionate person, that I truly turned my life around, that I was on a path somewhere. I was still touch and go. You know, like I had some serious charges behind me and had done jail time, and it was a concern, you know, like there was every chance that I may not get employed.
Not so relevant for Gavin, but here's a question to end for both of you, and that is, I guess we all sit down and we know that the 12-step program asks the participant to give in to a higher power. It doesn't have to be a formally religious one, but to understand that you can't control everything necessarily.
Yep.
Is there an element of what you have done in your recovery that says, to the question, why me? Why did I become an addict? Why was I born an addict? Does it give some sort of context to your entire life helping others now? So you can say, well, there was an overall grand plan for me, a good grand plan for me, and I guess that's why I travelled the road I did.
I hear what you're saying, and in some aspects I would say yes. You know, like I am who I am today. I have the passion that I have today, and I am in the position that I'm in my life, and just to add to that, like, I love it.
Mm.
I love my life. I love who I am today. But I could not have been this person without all the trouble that I'd been through first.
Gav?
Certainly not a conscious thing. But I believe my journey's only just beginning.
Yep.
In terms of how I can help and what I can do.
Yep.
Not where I can go personally, but where addiction and the drug use in the community and the society is really going. It's I think I'm just beginning on baby steps at the start.
And you'll be an important soldier on the front line in the fight against it.
Mm.
Your profile, this is a football mad town.
Yeah.
You're a Collingwood Premiership player that comes with a whole lot of exposure, and yep, the whole big picture might be, if you believe that somebody put you on this earth for a reason, it wasn't to win a premiership for Collingwood, it was to save hundreds, thousands or more lives and improve said lives. Gentlemen, once again, I just am humbled by your honesty and your willingness to come in here and help. Thank you, Mick Hall.
Thanks, Vonnie.
Thank you, Gavin Krasiska.
Thanks, boys.
Good on you, mate.
And thank you, listeners. It's another hour banked, and it's another hour worthwhile.